The next case is 2022-0603 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Tyree Daniel. The appellant has waived oral argument. On behalf of the state, dividing time with the State of Ohio, the Attorney General's Office, Ms. Jarrett. Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Evie Jarrett, appearing on behalf of Julia Bates, the prosecutor of Lucas County. I would like to divide my time with Mr. Hendershot, and I'll try to reserve 5 minutes of time, or maybe be more generous, as is appropriate. Just to put this into a little bit of context, given the fact that I'm first up, the appellant in this case has argued that the registration relief provision in the arson registry violates separation of powers principles for two reasons. First, he claims that it invades the province of the trial court to impose a sentence. And secondly, he says that it creates a problem with respect to the judicial review process. I think neither of those would be grounds for finding the registration relief provision to be a problem with respect to separation of powers. First, if we look at the arson registry as a whole, it's difficult to say that the registry creates any kind of punitive sanction that applies to individual offenders.
If you don't register as required, isn't that a felony?
It is a low-level felony. It's a fifth degree? That's correct.
So that isn't that something?
Well, of course, it's an independent offense. It's not an offense in and of itself. This is not creating an additional sanction beyond what the General Assembly has said is appropriate for the felony degree of the arson offense that would be before the trial court.
Isn't it an ongoing burden? Doesn't it have to be registration every year and a registration fee paid?
Sure, yes. I believe that it's an annual registration, perhaps a $50 fee up front, $25 thereafter.
Isn't that considered a collateral sanction?
I would consider it to be a collateral consequence, a civil collateral consequence of a conviction.
And we see that a fifth degree felony is a civil problem?
Well, there's only a felony if there's a violation. And of course, there are other things that we violate that create an independent, that create some sort of independent conviction.
So you're saying it's not part of the sentence?
That is correct, Your Honor. I would
contend how's it not? It's got to be told to the defendant at sentencing, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, that's correct. If the defendant before the trial court is a defendant who is going to be released on community control, the trial court then has an obligation to inform him of the duty to register under the arson registry. That doesn't exist if the individual is going to be incarcerated. Under those circumstances, the sheriff or the individual, the person in charge of the institution, has that duty. And to that degree, it actually weighs in favor of finding that it's a non-punitive.
How does that differ from suspension of a driver's license? I mean, once you're able to get your driver's license back, you have to pay a lot of restitution, a lot of reinstatement fees. If you fail to do that, or you fail to pay the $50, you're going to end up being convicted of another crime. In one case, driving without an operator's license, and in the other case, you're going to have another felony.
I do believe that that's an example of the kind of requirement that we generally face, that if we fail to comply with it, we may in fact have some criminal, whether it's a minor misdemeanor or something more serious,
sure,
may have some consequences as a result.
But a driver's license suspension is considered a collateral sanction, so why isn't having to pay the $50 fee every year and register?
Your Honor, I would view this as being exactly, they're very comparable. If we look at this court's recent decision in the Hubbard case, we see that kind of comparison where we're looking at the relation between the original crime as compared to the registration duties And this court held in Hubbard that the violent offenders database, which is more or less comparable to this statute, that that was not punitive in its effect.
The difference here, let me to understand, 2909.15d2b, it has to be the prosecutor and the agency, whoever the spokesperson is, who have to recommend to the judge that the registration period for the offender be less than lifetime.
It is different in its structure than many of the registries. I don't know offhand of any other registry where the prosecutor and the law enforcement officer can together go to the court and request relief from
and
the
it's
provision.
Specific. They have to request it. They can't, even defense counsel can't say, will you support my asking the court to do this?
I think that's an interesting question, but the way the statute is phrased, it anticipates the prosecutor and the law enforcement, the investigating agency making that request.
Counsel, isn't that language problematic in an adversarial system? What incentive would the state have to go and ask for a reduction for some defendants?
For registration that aids them.
Well, I think you make an excellent point that the registration is intended to aid law enforcement. We view it as being non-punitive in its intent for that reason. With respect to the incentive that the state may have to recommend, it can be a variety of reasons. Prosecutors exercise their discretion every day in a variety of different ways. It's not uncommon.
But it's not just the prosecutor, it's an agency too. And what if one wants to and the other doesn't?
And my, granted it's, you know, I have a microscopic view of my county, but it's pretty unusual for us to take a position that's adversarial to one another.
It might not be likely, but clearly that can happen. One individual, one branch could have veto authority over the request. And it's just the request because only then the trial court has discretion.
Correct. That is correct. It is just a request. And I suppose in some that there is the theoretical possibility that the law enforcement agency, the investigative agency, might for some reason have an issue that the prosecutor doesn't wish to address. It would be very unusual. I would compare this to a situation in our county where we pursue civil forfeitures on behalf of the investigating agency, and we do consult with them, and we get their approval before we enter into any kind of agreement with respect to resolution of those kinds of issues.
How does someone appeal the failure of the prosecutor or the refusal of the prosecutor to request less than lifetime registration?
I think the appeal right will kick in once the request is made and the trial court makes a decision. When the trial court exercises its discretion.
No, if the prosecutor doesn't ask the trial court, how does somebody appeal that?
I'm not sure that there would be a right of appeal at that point. As the Sixth District pointed out, the appeal comes from the exercise of discretion. I don't think that that's fatal to us in terms of the separation of powers. There are all kinds of mechanisms that the prosecution controls that aren't appealable. I mean, we select the charges. We can elect.
That's true, but that's before trial. That's before conviction. So in a matter where identical circumstances, an offender, and let's say it's a different prosecutor or a different law enforcement head or agency, and a defendant can show that his circumstances were identical or even less, where an offender was given a recommendation of less than a lifetime registration requirement, you're saying that the defendant can't even take those two identical cases and appeal in any way?
I think that the circumstance is something that we want to think about and we want to analyze it very carefully because it is structured differently than anything I know about. But it's not that out of line with one other thing that I can think of that occurs after conviction, and that's when the state has the right to select what conviction, it's going to proceed forward to sentencing on when there are two offenses that merge for purposes of sentencing. That, to me, I know of nothing that says that the defendant can say the state should have selected this offense as opposed to this other.
Well, but that's different in that the defendant is convicted of, say, two offenses. One is a lesser included, or they sure. through merger. And so that's kind of by that's a different scenario where that has to happen. So the prosecutor has to elect which one. It's a mandatory. Here, it's not mandatory that they make the request for reduction.
So I would just say that it's not mandatory that the prosecutors select the lower level. You know, Ohio has
a... That's true. That's true. But yes. It's mandatory that there be a selection.
Correct.
Yes. Under Bodike, aren't we required to be wary and lean against any usurpation by the executive branch of the judicial duties?
I think that I would look to the language, I believe it's in Bodike, that actually says that when we have separation of powers problems, it's something where there's a complete taking on of the power of the other branch. That language to me is very strong. We're looking at, I believe the language was only if one branch directly and completely administers the power of the other.
Isn't that what's happening here with that language? The judicial branch can't act unless the executive first says that they can consider it.
So it's a gateway, but there are gateways in criminal law in Ohio all the time.
Any similar mechanism of where someone would be burdened with a restriction where the prosecutor has to first request? Can you think of any other analogous mechanism? It's not under the sexual registration requirements.
So I would point to the charging decision. When we charge a case that involves the rape of a young child, for example, a prosecutor can charge it such that the trial court has life without parole, or it can charge a different offense that would be a lower level. The defendant doesn't have the ability to say, I should have been charged at this lower level.
But that's all before the finding of guilt.
Yes,
and so
that's correct.
Doesn't the executive branch, in effect, by giving its view, tell the sentencing judge whether the sentencing judge who may want to do something else should give community control versus time in prison? Isn't that determinative?
I would say it's not determinative. I wish that my recommendation to the trial courts would result in them doing what I want, but frequently it just doesn't happen.
But it can affect if the judge is on the borderline, whether community control or prison. It could have a huge effect on that.
Yes, I think that's correct. There's no denying that the prosecutor's request may in the end have an effect on what the judge does. But here, that discretion remains intact.
You're into the state's time.
I am. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
I'll yield the rest of my time to Mr.
Mr. Hendershot, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court. Yes.
Can I just start off? I know your time is short, but what would be the state's motivation for asking for less than a lifetime registration?
Well, just like when prosecutors make recommendations for less than a maximum sentence, prosecutors have an obligation to do justice in an individual case. And especially when you look at this statute that has the admittedly unusual feature of having the investigator mentioned, that of course just formalizes something that happens in prosecutors' offices all the time, consulting those who investigate the crime about what to do. Here, because it's an investigative tool, I think it makes a lot of sense not just to formalize something that happens already, but to ask the investigators, how should this investigative tool be used? And if people who specialize in arson investigation think this is not the kind of person that requires a lifetime registry, then they would make that recommendation. It certainly happens. I believe in the State v. Carlisle case that you considered, but then dismissed as improvidently granted, if I remember the record of that case correctly, there was a recommendation there. And certainly, as I understand, it happens not infrequently that there is a recommendation to do less than a lifetime registry.
But isn't it a recommendation against the state's interest?
I don't think it's against the state's interest when you think about the state's interest broadly, which is to
do justice.
Do justice in that case and to use this tool for what it's used for. I mean, in talking to prosecutors, admittedly in a different context, about the sex offender registry, sometimes there's frustration that there are too many people on the registry, right? And so they have an incentive to have the registry match what the investigative tool is for. And I think the experience, admittedly, I don't represent a particular county, so it's just based on conversations with folks around the state. They don't have an incentive to just maximize everyone being on the registry for life, and I don't think that is what is happening.
But flip that around, and how do you support the constitutionality of the judge being able to shorten that registration period only if there's a recommendation from the prosecutor?
Yeah, if I can make 2 points about that, and this is just a point about the sort of the meta structure of the argument here. One, the discussion that you've had with my colleague here about, is this even part of the sentence? I think if it's not part of the sentence, there's no separation of powers problem at all. It's just a collateral consequence, and there are dozens running to hundreds where the courts play no role, where there's consequences to crime, voting restrictions, gun ownership restrictions, what have you. But even if you think it's part of the sentence, let me give you 2 examples of ways that there is executive action that triggers judicial discretion.
Do you think this is a collateral sanction?
I think it's a collateral, so I guess collateral sanction, I think, maybe runs the risk of mixing what is punishment and what is collateral, a collateral consequence that is not punitive. And so if it's just a merely collateral consequence, like all the things that flow from being convicted of a crime, whether it's, I mentioned too, voting and gun ownership, there's restrictions on business and professional licenses, restrictions on college tuition aid. I mean, the list is much longer than that.
This is in the criminal statute, though.
It is in the criminal statute. It is not in the sentencing part of the statute. And State versus Hubbard, the case that you decided in 2021, considering the Sierra's Law Registry, actually made note of the fact that that was not part of the sentence. Now, I know that's just a plurality opinion of the court, but I think the logic applies here. It pointed to that registry is in Chapter 29, but it's not in the part that deals with sentencing. And the plurality there concluded that that registry obligation is not part of the sentence. But let's put all that aside, say that it is part of the sentence. Let me give you 2 examples of instances where executive action unlocks the door to judicial discretion. One is in the Reagan-Tokes Act. There's a provision where an executive actor, these are the folks that investigate the prisoners under their control, they unlock the courthouse door to reducing the sentence for those that they have evaluated and said the sentences should be shorter. The other example, and we collect the cases about this on page 12 of our brief, comes from federal law. To reduce below the minimum sentence for government cooperation, there's a federal statute that says only on the government's motion can the minimum sentence be, less than the minimum sentence be triggered. Every federal circuit court that we're aware of that has looked at that has said this is not a separation of powers problem. That's been on the books for 40 years. I think it operates just like the statute here. So I see them.
I want to go back to the issue of the law enforcement wants forever and the prosecutor, for whatever reason, doesn't. Do they both get to contact the court?
As I read the statute, I'm not aware of any case that raises this issue, because I think they're usually in sync on that, and I think that was true in Carlisle.
But if they're not?
If they're not, as an undecided issue, it looks to me like the statute says they each have an independent role.
It says and.
Correct. That's why, I think they each do have an independent voice there. So, yes, I think they would both have to.
So what does that tell the judge? If one says yeah and one says no?
Then it doesn't unlock that door. I don't think the number of executive actors matter. The question is, does unlocking the door, to stick with that metaphor, does it invade the judicial power? And I think it does not. That's why it's consistent with the Reagan-Tokes Act provision that does that. Just the number of actors is, I don't think, significant. The question is, is there a power here that invades the judicial power that's been conferred somewhere that invades it?
And here you have two executive branches.
Certainly there are two executive actors, yes. I don't think that changes the calculus of whether it invades judicial power. Admittedly, I can't point you to another statute that does that. I could tell you the federal statute that I've talked about by analogy just says on motion of the government. So that's on motion of the Department of Justice, its investigators and attorneys. So I think that is closely analogous. Now, I know I'm deep into the red colored part of the clock here, so I don't want to abuse that. Those are the things we've been talking about, not being part of a sentence and not being a problem of separation of powers, because unlocking the door is a common feature of judicial discretion. Those are independent reasons to affirm.
So just one more question. So if we disagree with you and find that it's unconstitutional, then what do we do?
Yes, thank you. So on the remedy, we think this is a conditional power. And so if the condition is a problem, then the power is a problem. Those are one package. We think under whether you approach that as a matter of just giving effect to the Constitution, under 1.50, under Geiger, all those we think are different paths to the same conclusion, which is it still leaves Mr. Daniel with a lifetime registration obligation. So that, I guess, just adds three to the list of different reasons that we think you should affirm the 6th District.
So you wouldn't bifurcate and say, and take off the part about unlocking the door, leaving that ability for the judge to shorten the registration. You would eliminate all of that completely so that the only alternative available to someone after, for instance, that part was severed from the statute, is that there'd be no shortened registration from lifetime. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor. I think it is a conditional power. The condition and the power go together. So it's like the OPAA brief, I think, points to a useful case on this score at page 15 of that brief. It's called Rezepik, and it said the method of counting votes and the result of counting the votes were a package that cannot be separated.
But that would fly in the face of, that would take away your discretion in those cases where you think it's should be lowered and would defeat the policy reasons behind the registration. It would take away the prosecutor's right to even voice agreement that it should be reduced.
Well, if you think that there's a separation of powers problem here, we don't think you can separate the condition and the power that it confers. The structure of the statute puts subpart A, making a lifetime registration obligation, subpart B, giving a conditional power. We think that is the best way to approach, if, of course, you disagree with the other two independent points of why there's no separation of powers problem to begin with. Thank you, Your Honor. We'd ask that you affirm.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you please recess the court?